Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Shri Bhakti Vaibhava Ki Jai. Rantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Jai Giriraj Maharaj Ki Jai. Jai Nidai Gopri Man. Tonight we'll review
the chapters 1 to 7 of the 4th canto in preparation for your exam, which is next Monday night, beginning at 7 p.m. in the Temple Theatre. So, we can go through the 7 chapters, and if anyone has any questions or comments they would like to make as we go through, then you can please add them. So the first chapter of the seventh canto is called? The fourth canto. The first chapter is called Genealogical Table of the Descendants of Manu. So it's described that Manu, Swayambhu Manu, he has between himself and his wife, Shatarupa, there are 5 children. Uttanapat, Priyavrata, just be careful, it might be sticky. Just be careful, because you might get some. Uttanapat, Priyavrata, that's a Shatarupa. Devahuti, Ashuti, and Prasuti. So to describe the 3 daughters of Swayambhu Manu and Shatarupa, they are described in detail in the first chapter in relation to their descendants. So Canto 4, Canto 5 and Canto 6 are a description of the descendants of Swayambhu Manu and Shatarupa. So this is 3 daughters, and then after the 3 daughters, settle down quickly. After the 3 daughters, then the descendants of Priyavrata, the pastimes of Priyavrata and Uttanapad will also be spoken of. So now the next 3 cantos will cover the descendants of Swayambhu Manu and Shatarupa. So in terms of the 10 subject matters of the Bhagavatam, then this is covering the subject matter of Manvantara and others also like that. But Manvantara means the Manus and the descendants of the Manus like that. So they're being described from the 4th canto through to the 5th canto and the 6th canto like that. So these 3 daughters, they had various children, and their various children married different personalities. So it's described all through that first chapter who are the different personalities who appeared from them. So several of the children who appeared from these daughters were incarnations of the Supreme Lord himself. We had what are some of the examples of some of the Narayana Rishi. Dattatreya. Soma. Like that. So it's described that they gave birth to various incarnations of God amongst other personalities. And these personalities and their descendants, they populated the universe. The population of the universe came from these personalities. So it is described that eventually each one of the daughters married other personalities, and different children came, including incarnations of the Lord. And then at the very end of the chapter, it is described that the daughter whose name was Prasuti, she gave birth to a number of children.
16? 16. 16 or 17? 16. 16 or 17. 13
were married to Dharma, and the others 3 were
the
only.
So, the 13 were married to Dharma.
Just be careful, because I think that might be sticky.
Then,
one of the daughters was married to the fire god. And then one was married to
Shiva.
Okay. That was the youngest daughter. Her name was Sati. And Sati was the favorite of Daksha, King Daksha. And he was her, she was his pet daughter, youngest daughter, and his favorite daughter. So she married Lord Shiva. So then in the beginning of chapter 2, it is described, what is chapter 2 called? Daksha curses Lord Shiva. So it is described that although Daksha gave his daughter in marriage to Lord Shiva, he was never particularly happy about the union between them, because Daksha's defect was that he was a materialistic brahmana. And when one is materialistic, when one is in the bodily concept of life, then one judges others according to external characteristics. So he was judging Lord Shiva according to his external appearance, because Lord Shiva is known as Tamasi. Tamasi means? He is the Lord of the mode of ignorance. So because he is Tamasi, because he is the Lord of the mode of ignorance, then he appears externally to be somewhat tamasic. But actually, as he describes himself in the third chapter, that he is always situated in Vasuddha Sattva. Now he's always situated in the pure mode of goodness. He's not affected by the modes of material nature. So because he's not affected by the modes of material nature, then he is not affected by his external appearance, even though he appears to be tamasic, but he's not actually influenced by the mode of ignorance. He's in control of the mode of ignorance. So Lord Shiva was not appreciated by Daksha. And Daksha entered into a sacrificial arena, because he had arranged a great sacrifice at the beginning of the universe. So he entered into the sacrificial arena, and because he was so effulgent and so powerful, then all of the brahmanas there, all the different personalities, they offered respect to him. They all stood up in respect, because as soon as he entered, he was so effulgent that practically everyone else became insignificant in his presence. So everyone stood up. And the nature of material conditioning is that when one receives some facility, one tends to become attached to that facility. And then one may become proud of that facility. So Queen Kunti says, Jan Maishwarya Shruta Shribiya. Mada means someone becomes intoxicated or mad. You become intoxicated. Janma, Aishwarya, Shruta, Shribya. There's different facilities, and then one becomes intoxicated. So you become proud. I am superior to others because I have these different facilities. I'm materially superior to someone else. So Daksha, he became proud of his material facility, being extremely learned, very handsome and very potent, and very wealthy, very influential. So because he had all of these material facilities, then he became proud of his material facilities. And he considered himself superior to others, and he considered himself superior to Lord Shiva. He thought, I am a Brahmana, I am in the mode of goodness, and Lord Shiva, he is in the mode of darkness, ignorance. So therefore, he entered into the sacrificial arena, and he saw that Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva were not standing. Like everyone else. So Lord Brahma offered him a seat. And he went to sit down, but then he saw that Lord Shiva was also not respecting him. So he became very angry. Because he was envious of Lord Shiva. He thought, who is he that he cannot offer me respect? Who is his father-in-law? So therefore, I am superior to him. He should offer me respect. So he became very angry. So this was due to his material contamination, his attachment, his covering, that he could not understand Lord Shiva's exalted position. So devotees have to learn to recognize the spiritual advancement of other devotees. You must judge devotees according to their spiritual advancement, not according to some material calculation. And if one can offer respect to devotees according to their spiritual advancement, then one remains safe on the path of devotional service. So he could not recognize Lord Shiva's exalted position. And therefore, he became, due to his pride and his envy, he became very angry at Lord Shiva. Now, we described in the beginning of the course that when one is dealing with superiors, then one has to take different things into consideration. Does anyone remember some of the different items that we mentioned?
Age.
Right, the age. No, that's different. Yeah. One thing is the seniority of the person.
Right?
Dependence.
Yeah, it's more, it's based on seniority. Right? The spiritual advancement of the person. Right? The age of the person. Right? The vana and the ashram of the person. These things must be taken into consideration. So this is what we must take into consideration when we deal with other devotees. You may be more spiritually advanced than another devotee, but if that devotee is older than you, then you must offer respect. And then if that devotee is more spiritually advanced than us, we must also offer them respect. And if a devotee is in a superior vana or a superior ashram to us, we must offer them respect. And if a person is more senior to us in years of devotional service, then we must offer respect. So these are the different considerations that we have to account for when we deal with other devotees. Close it properly, Russell. So we have to take all of these things into consideration. So unfortunately, the Lord Shiva was not able to understand the most important element when dealing with another devotee. Yeah, that's what I said. Daksha. Then Daksha was unfortunately not able to take into consideration the most important element when dealing with a devotee, and that is spiritual advancement. That if a devotee is spiritually advanced, then we have to learn to recognize these things. And it may not be so easy to do, because sometimes the advanced devotees may appear to be very simple from a material point of view. So then we think, oh, he's a very simple person, we don't offer proper respect, but the danger is we may commit some offence to that devotee. So we have to take into consideration all these things, and we must offer respect according to their position. And in this way we will avoid committing offences to the devotees. So he began to curse Lord Shiva. And he said that Lord Shiva, he said many things about him, that he was a tamasic personality, and that he only gave his daughter to Lord Shiva out of obligation under the order of Lord Brahma. Mm. So he actually insulted Lord Brahma himself, because he doubted the instruction of his father and his guru, who was Lord Brahma. So because he disrespected Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, then he committed a great, very serious offences to very exalted personalities. And the more exalted the personalities are, then the more severe the reaction of the offence becomes, or the more serious the offence is. When we offend very advanced devotees, then the offence is considered very serious and the reaction becomes very heavy. So he disrespected Lord Shiva, and he said that he has the eyes of a monkey. And my daughter Sati, she has the eyes of a doe, like that. So this is just, and the first verse that he spoke, he said, I'm not saying all of this out of envy. Yeah, so that's how bewildered he was. Because when we're envious of someone else, we try to cover it. We try to hide that envy. And we say, you may even say, oh, I'm not envious like that. But it was quite obvious that he was envious of Lord Shiva. So he offered great disrespect to Lord Shiva. And he insulted Lord Shiva. But Lord Shiva remained equipoised. And that is the position of a devotee. A devotee remains equipoised. A devotee does not take offence easily. This is the position of a Vaishnava. The Vaishnavas do not take offence easily. The devotees are not petty. They don't take offence over just small things like that. So Lord Shiva, he did not react. He remained equipoised. But unfortunately, his followers were not as exalted in consciousness as he was, and they were affected by the lower modes of nature, and they became angry. But it was not incorrect for them to defend their master. The best thing to do is to tolerate as much as we can. But if another devotee is persecuted, then we should react like that. So in one sense, they did not do the wrong thing, but everyone became very disturbed and very angry. So then Nandishwara, he began to curse Daksha left the sacrificial arena. He could not stay there anymore. He was so disturbed. So he left the sacrificial arena, and then...
He also cursed before that.
So Lord Shiva, he was cursed very heavily, but he remained equipoised. But Daksha left the Jagya because he was so disturbed in his consciousness. And then the followers of Lord Shiva, they began to curse the followers of Daksha, headed by Bhrigu Muni, the different Brahmanas. So they began to curse in a very angry mood. So in this angry mood, they said very severe curses. But actually, these curses, they predicted the consciousness that would prevail in the future in relation to these different personalities. Then the followers of Nandishwara said that all of you Brahmanas are simply attached to the material body. And because you're attached to the material body, then you're very ritualistic, you're very fruitive. And practically we see these days, especially now, that people who are so-called Brahmanas, that's what they're like. They're just very materialistic, very fruitive. They sometimes even run the temples or maintain the deities simply for material profit. Right? So it just becomes ritualistic. Right? We'll do some rituals, we'll do some puja, you give us some dakshina, right? And everything is like that. So it becomes caste Brahmanism. Now Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur fought very vigorously about this, against this caste Brahmanism. Right? Because it is materialistic, it's based on materialistic consciousness that I am a Brahmana by birth. But no one is a Brahmana by birth. Kalos, Sudros, Sambhava. Everyone is Sudra or less by birth. Everyone is unqualified by birth. So one becomes purified or Brahminical by training, by purification, by qualification, by training. Then someone becomes qualified to be a Brahmana. So then when people who are born in so-called Brahmana families adopt the position of Brahmana from a caste perspective by birth instead of by guna and karma, by quality and activity, just by jamma, by birth, then they become degraded in consciousness and they become materialistic and it becomes fruitive and they perform the sacrifices or the worship of the deities simply based upon material profit and gain. Like that. So that was the curse which took place from the followers of Lord Shiva towards the Brahmanas, that you will all become like this. Actually, you're already like this, but you shall remain. And they said you should not become self-realized. So it was a very heavy curse that we saw. Any questions or comments at this point? Somewhere.
This curse, Brahmanas, is especially applicable to the age of Kalpa, in the previous yugas.
Yeah, in the previous yugas, many Brahmanas, not Vaishnavas, just caste, because this is back in the beginning of the universe, and we see it was already there. So in all the yugas, there's always this kind of thing takes place. Just like I was at Premadam's last night, and he had one like calendar on the floor, and then I picked up the calendar. It was from some Indian Airlines or something. And I turned it over, and it had some fake guru on the back, some bogus guru. And I was reading what it said, and he was saying that I guarantee you 100% happiness. What's his name?
Yeah, that
one. The old guy. Yeah, he's an old guy with a white beard. That's him, right?
Advertisement.
Huh?
Advertisement.
Yeah, so he's advertising that you follow me and I will make you 100% materially happy. Right? So this is just bogus. Right? Because, for a start, you can't be 100% materially happy. And secondly, he didn't speak anything about spiritual life. So that, what sort of Brahminical life is that? Now, what does the word Brahman mean by definition? Right? The word Brahman means someone who is situated in Brahman or spirit. So this person is supposed to be a Brahmana, but simply all he offers you is material benediction. So this is the situation of the Brahmanas in the material world. Is that door shut for? Okay.
Yeah,
but he says chant and be happy. It's cool.
Maybe he was offering some.
Well, I can show you the calendar if you want. Okay. But no, he wasn't.
He's not. He's really bogus.
Completely. Yeah. It's just mundane. It's material like that. So this is the result. This is the way that Brahminical life has become. But it's been there since the very dawn of the creation. since the very beginning of the universe. And it's always there. There are always this kind of element of caste Brahmins. And that's why Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur was so adamant to establish Vaishnavism. Because Vaishnavism is based upon the teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam does not teach Brahmanism. It teaches Vaishnavism. Mm-hmm. Bhagavad Dharma. Sanatan Dharma. Right? Not casteism. Not some material consideration. So it is not material. Brahminical life is important. It is necessary for Brahmanas to be there. And Prabhupada said ISKCON is to train a society of Brahmanas, but Vaishnava Brahmanas. Not Brahmanas who are simply caste Brahmanas or smarter Brahmanas. Did that answer what you were asking?
Yes.
Okay. So then, the counter curse came from Bhrigu Muni. So Bhrigu Muni is very powerful and he counter cursed to defend the Brahmanas who had been cursed. So his curse is also very powerful, and he cursed that the followers of Lord Shiva would also be devoid of understanding true spiritual knowledge. And they would all become atheistic, which is what we see the followers of Lord Shiva generally are.
The followers of Lord Shiva generally in these days are the followers of Shankaracharya,
who is an atheist, is an impersonalist. And the followers of Lord Shiva are generally following Shankaracharya, who is none other than Lord Shiva himself, who is preaching this Mayavada doctrine of impersonalism, of covered atheism. So it is actual, although they call it spirituality, it is actually covered atheism. It is atheistic because they are denying that God is a personality. So it is covered atheism, this Mayavada philosophy. So they are teaching like this. So he, Bhrigu Muni, cursed that the followers of Lord Shiva would become like this, atheistic. And they would become very tamasic. He said they would all have matted locks of hair, and they'll have ashes on the body, and they will all follow Lord Shiva's external appearance, but they will not have the consciousness of Shiva. So this will be there, and practically we see this is what happened because of these curses at the beginning of the creation. We see that the Brahmanas have become degraded, and we see the followers of Lord Shiva have also become degraded because Vaishnavanam Yatana Shambhu, Shiva is the greatest devotee. So if one actually follows Shiva, he will be a devotee. If one actually follows Shiva, he will not be materialistic. Following Shiva does not mean dressing like Shiva. That is actually an imitation of Shiva. That's not following him. The Vaishnavas follow Shiva because we understand from the Bhagavatam what is his consciousness. In the sixth canto, we see that he is meditating on Lord Sankarsana. So he is absorbed in Krishna consciousness. He says it himself in the next chapter, in the third chapter. So that is Lord Shiva's position, that he is fully absorbed in consciousness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he is not an ordinary personality. Whereas those who follow him, they imitate him and they try to follow his external example, but they don't understand his inner consciousness. Whereas the Vaishnavas, we understand the inner consciousness of Lord Shiva. The inner consciousness of Lord Shiva is Krishna consciousness. But we don't follow his external behavior. We don't dress like him or act like him. But we understand, we do follow him because we understand his example and his teachings which are given throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam.
If Lord Shiva's external appearance is also a symbol of renunciation,
What's auspicious?
Lord Shiva, even though it may appear to be material, but it is actually telling the fact that he is still auspicious, not just auspicious, even though he has called, he stayed in the Amishan behavior, and then he knows that he is telling the fact that the body is going to be burned up.
So then, after this cursing and counter-cursing takes place, Lord Shiva is very morose, he's very upset, he's disappointed. And that's how a devotee feels. A devotee does not like to argue with others. We don't like to have disagreements with other devotees. So Lord Shiva, he deals with it in the best way. He sets the proper example. Because what is the main teaching of this entire seven chapters, of this entire pastime?
Never offend Vishnu.
Yeah, to avoid Vaishnava Parad. Right, that's the main teaching of this entire, that's the main theme of this entire section of the Bhagavad Gita. So he teaches us how to deal with this situation. We should avoid these angry types of atmospheres. Right? Because the nature of anger is the more you feed it, then the worse it becomes, the stronger it becomes. Right? So therefore when we're arguing with someone and we become angry and then they become angry, then everyone becomes more angry. So devotees have to learn to avoid this kind of situation. To become humble, to become tolerant, to become silent, and not to invoke the other person, not to provoke the other person and make them more angry. So Lord Shiva teaches us how to deal with this. He remains silent, he remains equipoised, he remains detached, and he leaves the sacrificial assembly. He doesn't become involved in cursing and counter-cursing. But he shows the ideal example of a Vaishnava that we should follow. We should imbibe the mood of Lord Shiva, the teachings of Lord Shiva, the example of Lord Shiva. Right? How to avoid committing Vaishnava Aparadha. So then he leaves the sacrificial arena, and then the sacrifice continues afterwards. And then the sacrifice is completed, the first sacrifice of Daksha. So then chapter 3 is called the talks between Lord Shiva and Sati. So we see at the beginning of chapter 3 that Sati sees that everyone in the universe is heading towards the Daksha Jagya, the second Jagya. So naturally she wants to go, right? So Prabhupada explains in the first part of this third chapter that the nature of the living entity is to be social by nature. We need social interaction, social discourse. It's natural for devotees to want to go to festivals where there's social gatherings of other devotees. We like to go to festivals, and it's auspicious when at the festivals everyone is in a happy mood. That is auspicious. So we naturally want to go. If everyone else in the universe is going, then obviously we would feel exactly like Sati, that we'd also like to go. So the husband and wife, Prabhupada explains in this early part of the third chapter, that the husband and wife must remain as one unit. They must remain cooperative, and they must remain supportive of each other to attain the same goal. So this is very important. Sometimes the husband and wife, they have disagreements, but these disagreements should be avoided as much as follows. Especially on small things, it's unstoppable. The husband and wife will always disagree on small things. But on the big things, important things, and Krishna conscious principles, then there should be full cooperation. And the wife should always follow the husband in that respect. Whatever decision that he makes in terms of Krishna consciousness, she should always give full support. Like that. So that is the principle of grihastha life, of married life. You like that one? I'm getting support from my friends. Good. Everyone's happy. Anyone want to question anything I said tonight? So. It's on the tape. You can listen to it later. So this is the principle. Yeah, if it's like that. Yeah. Okay, so then you can go home tonight and argue who's more advanced. Okay. Yeah. Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes one's more advanced, but the other one might still be more dominant or something. But generally, it should be like that. The general principle is the wife should follow the husband. Like that.
The wife is more advanced.
It means that the wife is clearly more advanced. Clearly. What it means is that on the small things, the wife may be more dominant. Like with my wife, I let her have, in terms of the household, I let her take the lead. Yeah, she makes all the decisions on the household, like that. But on the big things, I make the decisions, like that. So the husband should be qualified that he can make those decisions and he can lead the family properly. That should be... Sometimes it may be like that. It may not be 100%. Sometimes it may be that the wife is the more Krishna conscious of the two. But as a general principle, it should be like that. There should be cooperation between the two parties like that in order to achieve the final goal of Krishna consciousness.
It's a natural number because husband is older than the wife, so they will follow and they can go to the wife to follow.
Yeah, in a Vedic context, in Kali Yuga everything becomes somewhat mixed up. That's why in the Vedic context it was like that. Generally, in the Vedic times, the girl would get married at the age of 12 and the husband would be 25. So automatically she follows him. But these days, you know, usually there's only 1 or 2 years difference or something like that. You guys complicate everything. Doesn't matter what I say, you find some. Just try to be simple. Don't be complicated.
Mother Sita was older than Lord Rama.
Was she?
Yes.
Was she?
Mother Sita was older than Lord Rama.
Is it?
No. That Radharani was older.
Mother Sita is older than Lord Rama.
No.
Seems very strange.
Okay, so shall we get back to the 7 chapters we're talking about? So the basic principle is that the wife should follow the husband. That is the basic principle. If it's not like that in your marriage, then you work it out. Okay, that is the basic principle. It should be like that. So, it means, as I said, on the big things. On the small things, you know, you can work that out. But on the big things, it should be like that. So then, Sati, she speaks very humbly to Lord Shiva. And she says that, "My Lord, if you desire to go, then we should go to this yajna." Okay. But then the most of the chapter is dedicated to Lord Shiva instructing Sati that it would be inauspicious, disadvantageous for us to attend the yajna, because Daksha is unfortunately envious of Lord Shiva. And because he is envious of Lord Shiva, then he will commit offences to Lord Shiva, and he will also disrespect Sati, and this will be intolerable for her. So Prabhupada glorifies Sati near the end of the chapter, because Srila Prabhupada explains that Sati is actually to shut it properly. Sati is actually properly motivated to attend the sacrifice because she wants to protect the honor of and the reputation of Lord Shiva and his exalted position. She wants to protect that. Yeah. So that's why she wants to go. Although Prabhupada says earlier in the chapter that Sati, her mind is taking control and that she wants to attend the sacrifice because it's her womanly desire to attend. Yeah, weakness. But Prabhupada then he explains further on that the actual purpose, yeah, Prabhupada just makes a point in the first seven verses or so. But later on he says the main reason is that we should always protect the honour of another devotee. This should be our principle. That if Krishna or a devotee is being blasphemed, offended, then we should defend Krishna. We should not tolerate any blasphemy towards Krishna or Krishna's devotees. When either Krishna or Krishna's devotees are blasphemed or disrespected, then we should defend them. And it becomes a fault on our behalf if we do not defend them. Right? If we hear that someone is offending and we do not defend, we also become implicated. We also become involved in offence. Right? It is wrong on our behalf not to protect Krishna, right? Not to protect the devotees if they are being offended. So, any questions or comments at this point?
It's interesting that Lord Brahma himself, being a Vaishnava, he did not chastise his lotus feet.
Daksha? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to say why he didn't do that. But. Any point?
Kandishwara and the Jagumani, they were casting and contacting on behalf of their master because they were feeling that their master was. So how to understand that one and this one? Like this one is said that Sati was.
Because things got a little bit out of hand. Mm-hmm. The curses were very heavy.
Mm-hmm. That's why it was.
Yeah, it's like if you know, if I say something which offends you, then. Oh no, if I say something like, if I offend another devotee, and then you say, hey, that is not correct. But then you don't say, okay, now you'll become a frog, you know, and then why curse you, and then like, that's what happened. Yeah. Yeah, well, it wasn't that they just defended, like, it wasn't they just said, oh, you know, this is incorrect, you should not have spoken like this about Lord Shiva, but then they said, okay, all of you will become like this. And then Bhrigu said, yes, but all of you will become... So then the whole thing got out of hand. So the mood should not be like... The devotees don't act like that. You know, it really came down to a competition between Shiva Tejas and Brahman Tejas. You know, who is more powerful? That's what it came down to. It just came down to egos. Yeah. It's because Prabhupada explains that these days, when everyone wants to show who is superior, they go and play football. Right, you get a football and you run out in the MCG and then you run up and down and run up and down and then whoever at the end, then they're superior. But back then they showed it through Brahminical teachers. That's who was more powerful, who had more potency. So they would curse and counter curse and do like that. Yeah, it's a Prajapati, so the Prajapatis are very powerful. So, okay. Because we see when he entered the assembly, everyone stood up. All the fire gods stood up and everyone. So. Any other points? Yeah. Someone else put their hand up?
He was respecting the Moksha already by kind of see somebody offering the respect to the successful within. And that very Shiva was already offering
respect. Yeah. So then, Lord Shiva, he tries to persuade Sati not to go, but then she leaves, and she takes all of his followers with her, and she heads towards the Daksha Yagya. So then, the fourth chapter is called Sati Kutsa Bodhi. So she arrives at the Daksha Yagya, and she is well received by her sisters and her mother. But she's not given any reception by her father, Daksha. So naturally she becomes very disturbed, very upset. So immediately she begins to criticize, rightfully, the position of Daksha. So she begins to point out his defects. And she says that you are simply envious of a great soul. This is your defect, your position. Now, we did mention that there were six types of offences or aparas that one can commit towards devotees. Does everyone have a record of those six types of offences? Does anyone not have a record of the six types of offences? You don't have? Yeah, it is. You are going to be questioned on it, so yeah, so you do need to know. Does anyone have the six steps? Because they got scrubbed off the board. So I don't have the six in front. Yeah? Prabhu? Say the first one.
Do not feel joy upon seeing a devotee.
Okay.
Master smile.
Like that. Mm-hmm. Have you got these, Shekhar? No. You haven't got? Mm-hmm. Then you have to copy off one of the devotees. Have you got them? What about Bandhu Prabhu? Have you got them?
Yes,
you have? So you can get off your husband. He's got them. So you don't have them, Russell? Oh, you have them? Okay. So the first is not to feel joy upon seeing a devotee. So it means not to smile when you see a devotee. Not to be happy. You see a devotee, you should be happy. Sometimes someone sees us and they look down or they look away, or, you know, it's actually an offence because the devotee feels bad. You see that devotee and then automatically you feel unhappy, then they feel bad, then some slight offence is there, there's something there. And second offence is? To fail to offer respects or obeisances. To not show some respect. Like a devotee comes to your home and then you don't offer them some water, you don't offer them a place to sit, you don't offer them some kind words, right? The best thing that you can offer someone is sweet speech. That is best. Because you can give everything else, but if there's no sweet speech, it's not satisfying. If you give sweet speech, even if you only have water and a straw mat, they'll be happy. You may only have, you don't have any facility, you only have like a straw mat and a glass of water, but if you give sweet speech, then everyone will be satisfied. And the third one is?
To get angry at a devotee.
Sometimes you get angry at devotees. You can only become angry when you are a superior devotee, and when you're a senior devotee. Then sometimes, if you need to, you get angry at the junior devotees. But it is not typical. It's not something that we should do often, or whimsically, or we should have control of our anger, as Rupa Goswami says. And the fourth one is?
To envy
a devotee. To become envious. Where's Merlin? Huh? Where is he? He didn't come last night.
Yeah, last night.
He wasn't there. So, I hope he's around. He'll probably listen to him. That one is to become, what's the fourth one?
Envious.
To be envious of a devotee. To show envy through your words, through your speech, or through your thoughts. Okay. And then? To blaspheme a devotee. To commit aparad, to say negative things. And this happens very commonly. And devotees criticize other devotees unnecessarily. And then the final one?
To kill a devotee.
This one you should not do. Otherwise you'll fail the whole course. Okay.
The first three out of the six offences, are the offences against the holy name as well?
They're all offences against the holy man, because the first offence is the devotees. So this is the six types of blasphemy. Is the division of those six. So this is the first offence against the holy man. All these six. So one should not commit these types of offences. Like that you will be examined on this. So memorize the six. I'll probably write the exam tomorrow, so I'll have to think of what question we'll write, but it will be something about these six like that. So then, Sati, she begins to criticize Daksha and explain to him that he is unnecessarily criticizing Lord Shiva. And his entire consciousness is based upon envy of Lord Shiva. Envy is the reason we come to this material world. And this whole material world operates upon envy. And when we are envious of others, that's why we commit offences. Offences are committed because of envy. That is the root cause of our offences. Envy makes us proud. When we become proud, we may commit offences to others. So then, if he tries to point this out to him...
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
It happened with me a couple of times when the devotees in the temple, sometimes they show anger and they turn it loose. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean, turn it loose, they just do it without getting in any control.
Yeah.
And later on, they come back and they are sorry.
Yeah.
But that time, you know, being at the receiving end, we don't know how to react. And it happens couple of times, and it's like the ritual, they come again, they say again sorry. So what do you have to do at the time, or just
at the time, then try to tolerate it if you can, just try to leave that place, put a gulab in their mouth. Different things you can do. It depends on the situation.
But we try to dilute the situation, or we try to say, okay, Prabhu, why is this?
Yeah, try to dilute it, to do whatever you can. Sometimes use humour. You know, sometimes someone gets angry with you, you just tickle them. Then suddenly they're not angry anymore. So different things you can do.
Maybe they could become more angry.
So you have to see which person it is. So you cannot give one answer because it's different according to the person. Like that. But try to do whatever you can. At least tolerate it as much as you can.
So you think tolerating is better than trying to talk to them at this stage?
Like I said, it depends on the person. You have to see which person it is and how they react. Like that, so.
Somebody will come and ask for forgiveness, and I don't even know what happened. I tell them, why you are asking? I don't even know what you did with me. You didn't do anything to me. Why you are asking? No, I didn't. I didn't even know about that.
Yeah, so that's the offense. That means the offense wasn't very serious. So.
Krishna will look after me. If you commit offenses, then Krishna will definitely give you the reaction.
So then, Sati, she gives this good counsel to Daksha, but Daksha does not take the counsel. So she becomes very angry at Daksha. And actually, she can destroy Daksha because she is Durga. She's more powerful than Daksha. She is the wife of Lord Shiva, the sun personification of the material energy. She's the Durga Devi herself, so she could kill him, but she understands it is not her position to kill him. So therefore, she decides to kill herself, because she doesn't want to have any connection with him. So therefore she combusts her body, self-combusts, which means she meditates on the heat within her body, the fire element, and she increases that, and she burns her body into ashes. And Daksha is so hard-hearted that he does not even feel pain that his daughter has given up her body, and then he continues his sacrifice. And then we get to chapter 5. Chapter 5 is called?
Frustration of the sacrifice of Daksha. So Daksha, Narad Muni, he approaches Lord Shiva and he explains to him that Sati has quit her body. So then Lord Shiva becomes extremely angry. Now this is the position of a senior Vaishnava. If a senior devotee becomes angry at us, then that is mercy. That is for our benefit. That is beneficial for us. So therefore we have to learn to accept that. So Lord Shiva, he was not malicious. He was not ill. He was not feeling ill towards Daksha. He simply wanted to correct Daksha's mentality. Because Daksha was very proud. So therefore he became very angry at him that he was developed such a improper attitude, and he committed a great apparat against him and also against Sati. So therefore he wanted to correct him, punish him. So then he created the great demon called Virabhadra, and Virabhadra went to the sacrificial arena on behalf of Lord Shiva, and he destroyed the entire sacrificial arena, right? With all the followers of Lord Shiva. So he ripped off, Virabhadra ripped off the moustache of Vrikul, knocked out the teeth of Pusha, took out the eyes of Bhaga, and finally Virabhadra tried to take off the head of Daksha. He tried to decapitate his head. But Daksha was very powerful. He is extremely powerful Brahman. So he was chanting mantras as Virabhadra was trying to cut his head. Virabhadra was sitting on his chest and he was trying to cut his head off with different swords and different things. And he was chanting mantras to protect himself. So he's very powerful. It was a very powerful struggle between Brahminical Tejas and Shiva Tejas. So finally, then Virabhadra, he grabbed him, picked him up and he took him over and put him into the device where they cut the goat's heads off, puts him in there and then he cuts his head off finally. So Shiva Tejas overcame Brahminical Tejas like that, because Shiva is extremely powerful. And then he took the head and everyone cried in disbelief that Daksha had been beheaded, such a powerful leader. And then Virabhadra was extremely angry. He picked up his head and he offered it as an oblation into the fire, threw it into the southern side of the sacrificial arena as an offering, as an oblation. And then he returned to Lord Shiva and he said, the mission is accomplished. So then chapter 6 is called Brahma satisfies Lord Shiva. So all the devatas, they go to the Lord Brahma, and all of them are injured. They've been attacked very severely by the followers of Lord Shiva, and they go to Lord Brahma and they say that we have committed a great offence. We have offended Lord Shiva. So Lord Brahma says that Lord Shiva's position is extremely powerful. He is the guna avatar, which means he is the incarnation of the Lord in control of the mode of ignorance. An extremely powerful personality. So he says that you have committed a great offence against this great personality. He said, now we must all go to Mount Kailas and we must beg forgiveness of this great personality. So all the devas, they begin to travel to Mount Kailas with Lord Shiva. Lord Brahma, to visit Lord Shiva. So there's a description of the beauty of Mount Kailas, because Kailas is an extremely auspicious place. It is a holy dharm, a holy place. It is the abode of Lord Shiva. So they travel towards Mount Kailas in order to visit Lord Shiva. As we mentioned in that class where we spoke about that, then we mentioned that of all the holy mountains in the universe, the supreme mountain is Sri Govardhan. So we are most fortunate because right now we are residing on the side of Govardhan Hill. So we're in the most auspicious place in the universe right now, because we are residing next to Govardhan, which is the most auspicious mountain in the universe. Wherever there is a Govardhan Shila, the entire of Govardhan Hill is manifest. Giriraj is fully manifested. We can't see. We can't even see anything. We're so dull. But we don't understand that actually Govardhan is fully manifest here. Fully. The entire of Govardhan Hill. Which means the entire Vrindavan is fully manifest here. So this is how auspicious this is. So they travel to Mount Kailas in order to meet Lord Shiva. And finally they arrive there and they meet Lord Shiva, who is meditating and who is surrounded by many great personalities such as Narada, the four Kumaras, Kuvera, right? So many great personalities have come to hear from Lord Shiva. So Lord Brahma, he comes and he offers respects to Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva sees Lord Brahma, who is his father, in terms of their relationship in this world. So he stands up to offer respect to Lord Shiva. Sorry, to Lord Brahma. So Lord Brahma, he smiles because he's a little nervous that Lord Shiva may be very angry, and he knows what it's like when Lord Shiva becomes angry. Because right? When Lord Shiva gets angry, the whole universe is in danger. He's the one who destroys the universe at the end of the creation, and the pralaya. Yeah, he is the one who actually destroys the entire universe. So he's extremely powerful. So Brahma tries to pacify him. And he says to Lord Shiva that you are a great personality, and no doubt you are transcendentally situated. But still, it is the nature of great souls to show tolerance to others and to show mercy to others. So you have destroyed the entire sacrificial arena of Daksha. But great souls, they do not take offense very seriously. So even though you have been offended by Daksha, but it is not appropriate for someone of your level to act the way that you acted. You should not have taken so much offense and become so angry. So please reinstate the demigods and Daksha, the Prajapatis, and please forgive them, and please allow them to continue their jagya, to finish everything that they have begun. Okay. So then, chapter 7 begins. Chapter 7 is called? The
sacrifice.
Yeah, the sacrifice. The third sacrifice. So then finally, the Lord Shiva speaks. And he said that I have not taken these offences very seriously. Now, because they are just childish, less intelligent devas. So I have not taken this very seriously. I will forgive them. I will reinstate everything as it was before. But I will have to remind those who were the most serious offenders of their offence. So Daksha shall keep the head of a goat. And Bhrigu shall keep the beard of a goat, and Kusha shall not be able to eat properly, and Bhaga shall not be able to see properly, and like this. So you can imagine, if you're a very important personality, any of us would find it somewhat difficult to have a goat's head, or the beard of a goat. It would be quite difficult. What to speak if you're like them, like Daksha or Bhrigu. I mean, these are very prominent personalities. So for them to have a goat's head or a goat's beard, it's a great... It's a great dishonour. So for them to have that situation, it's something they have to live with. It would keep you very mindful of your offence, of what you did previously. So Lord Shiva takes all the demigods back to the sacrificial arena, and then he gets he orders that they attach the head of the goat to the body of Daksha. And then when Daksha awakens, then he understands his offense. His consciousness has changed. This is why devotees correct us. This is why our guru corrects us. This is why we are chastised by senior devotees. Because it is good for us. Right? It brings us to our senses. Because sometimes we're in the wrong consciousness. And we need to be corrected by more senior devotees. So the senior devotees, they correct us because they want to bring us to the proper state of consciousness. So Lord Shiva, he corrected Daksha just to bring him to the right state of consciousness, and we see that Daksha has a complete change of heart. Before he was so envious of Lord Shiva, now he honours and respects Lord Shiva, and he says, "My Lord, please forgive me for my offence." So then he begins to perform the sacrificial, the sacrifice for the third time. And when he, now that he's in purified consciousness, now that he has devotional consciousness, right, now he's purified, he begins to offer the sacrifice, and then Vishnu himself appears. And everyone realizes when Lord Vishnu appears that he is superior even to Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, which is what the Bhagavatam is teaching us. That Vishnu or Narayan and ultimately Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. And all others are simply expansions or incarnations or partial representations. So Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, everyone becomes insignificant when Lord Vishnu appears in the sacrifice. So Lord Vishnu appears and then Daksha offers prayers to Lord Vishnu. And then all of the great personalities offer prayers to Lord Vishnu. And then, at the end of offering their prayers to Lord Vishnu, then Lord Vishnu begins to speak. And he indicates that we should not, he indicates to Daksha that he is not satisfied when his devotees are not properly respected. The Lord is not satisfied when the demigods are disrespected. He's not satisfied when the devotees are disrespected. He's not satisfied when he is disrespected. So therefore he points this out to Daksha, that you should be very careful about respecting the devotees, about respecting the demigods, about respecting the Lord himself. So when Daksha begins to offer the offering, the oblations to the Lord, the his portion of the sacrifice to the Lord becomes smiles, he's very satisfied. And then everything ends up auspiciously. Part of Vedic playwriting, when you write a drama within the Vedic in the Vedic context, one of the laws of drama in the Vedic, from the Vedic perspective, is that the ending must be auspicious. Must always have a happy ending. You see, sometimes in Kali Yuga they have very strange endings to the films. You're watching the film and it goes on and then suddenly the person dies. And it's like, you know, no happy ending. That's inauspicious. It's not good. The Vedic, everything must end auspiciously. You see, like the Ramayana ends auspiciously. The Mahabharata ends auspiciously. The Bhagavatam, all the different stories end auspiciously. So, this pastime ends auspiciously. Daksha is in an auspicious state of consciousness. The Lord has been worshipped. Lord Shiva has been honoured. Sati has moved on. But it is mentioned that she is reunited with Shiva. So everything is auspicious like that. That is devotional life. If you live your life according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, everything becomes auspicious. Everything is mangala. It's auspicious. Okay.
So, I think the other thing is the there was also the five obstacles to pure devotional service that result from offences.
Does everyone have a note of those ones?
Yes.
You've got them? So there will also be a question in regards to these five. Okay, so please also memorise these. Memorise the six offences, memorise these five obstacles, and chant and be happy. Shri Prabhupada ki, Daksha Yajna ki.
Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Any questions or comments? Final? That's what Krishna teaches. Any other points? So next Monday night we'll have the exam at 7 o'clock in the theatre. So we'll see you then. Hare Krishna. Thank you.